This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, a bittersweet Christmas for evacuees from Tonga's 2022 eruption and tsunami. They've finally arrived home, but not to their island of Atata, destroyed in the blast.
Today I'm staying in my new home. We feel free to come to our new home, but we're not the same with Atata.
And an informal market for betel nut has opened up between Solomon Islands and Australia, but it's put some exporters in some hairy situations.
Sniff a dog, gonna check everyone here. When the dog came up to me, the dog just sniffed my pocket and then sit down straight.
We'll also get some tips on how to preserve your mental health from Vanuatu's only practicing psychiatrist. All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, let's head to Fiji, where the cost of living was one of the key issues raised by voters as they went to the polls in December. The Minister for Women, Children and Poverty Alleviation, Linda Tambuya, has announced that she'll review Fiji's social welfare allowance in her first 100 days in office. But could accusations from the opposition derail those plans? To hear more about the government's plans, we are joined on the program by Linda Tambuya herself, Bulavanaka Minister.
Bulavanaka, thank you for having me.
Now, I do want to get into these plans that you have to address poverty in Fiji, Minister Tambuya. But first, I want to get your thoughts on some concerns around law and order that have been raised by the opposition. Now, you yourself were investigated and charged by Fiji's Anti-Corruption Commission before the election. Some claimed that that was a politically motivated move. Now you are in government. What's the status of that particular case?
Thank you. Well, because it's still in court, I'm unable to discuss the substantive bit of it, but it is still before the court. I am still faced with the charge. Now, of course, I am, in the process of getting my lawyer to write into the office to review the evidence in the case. It is a case of an accusation of vote buying in a period where the campaign period was happening. So I would like to have that revisited.
Mm. And as part of your moves in government, I mean, you were one of a number of cases that people said the laws were used to quash opposition in the run-up to the election. As part of your role in government, will you assess those laws?
Absolutely. I mean, ever since 2014, when the new election rules have come into place, there has been quite a number of laws that have been put in place that seen the elimination of very potential, good opposition members who wanted to run. For example, trade unionists have been eliminated from participating in elections. If they want to participate, they need to resign from their position as trade unionists in order to compete in the election. So that is pretty much, quelled any interest from the trade union bloc to run in the elections. And then there's also the rules around campaign rules around funding, where there has been a requirement to disclose every single transaction that happens between a member of the public and a candidate. And even a member of the public can be taken to task, even as simple as buying a roti parcel or a small pie, for $2, you have to account for that. So it's become really, a lot of work for candidates to be submitting all of that. And so we see that the rules were weighed heavily against opposition in this regard. The reporting mechanisms were enforced against opposition, but when there would be complaints against the ruling party, they would either be dismissed or delayed. Mm. So this was a repeat pattern through all the, throughout the elections, the three elections we've had. And we need all of these to be reviewed and removed so that we can have a better atmosphere and a freer atmosphere for candidates to campaign for elections. Mm.
And now, Minister Tambuya, you are part of the ruling party, or one of the ruling parties, I should say. But the opposition still have some concerns, the former ruling party themselves. I want to ask you about former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama's recent comments. He's accused your government of acting unconstitutionally in asking the police commissioner to step down. Let's take a listen first for a bit of what he had to say.
Rubuka, we think, is caught in a time bomb. He thinks that he's still the 80s and 90s. He and his 29 ministers and assistant ministers believe that being in government, they can do anything they like. They believe they can remove or appoint anybody they like from the civil service, boards and commissions, and diplomatic positions without following the constitution or the law.
That was, of course, former Prime Minister and now Leader of the Opposition, Frank Bainimarama there. Now, Minister Tambuya, well, firstly, I want to ask if you accept those allegations from Mr. Bainimarama. But more broadly, considering those strong words, those war of words, in fact, from the Fiji First Party, do you believe you can work with your counterparts on the opposition in Fiji First?
Well, to start off with, the Constitutional Officers Commission, which is the commission that is that needs to discuss and determine the constitutional officers, including the Commissioner of Police, met on Friday, and it included the Leader of Opposition as a member of that Constitutional Officers Commission. And it appeared the feedback we got was that it was a calm discussion and he understood where the government stood. But then his statement came after that meeting. So there was obviously some, you know, a different picture painted by the Leader of Opposition in that meeting compared to his statement, which was contradictory in itself. However, you know, his accusations we reject as a government. I reject as a minister. You know, if there is anything we are doing, we are following processes. It is the right of any new government that comes into power to ask individuals to resign. I think that is the more humane thing to do rather than to terminate. You know, if there is any issue that the Leader of Opposition or the Commission of Police have, then they should seek a constitutional redress. They should seek a constitutional challenge, which would be the proper process. He is alleging that we are not following proper processes. We are. We're going through the Constitutional Officers Commission, then he should do the same and follow due process. If he has an accusation or complaint, then, you know, take the legal recourses that are available to them.
You've just come in as Minister for Women, Children and Poverty Alleviation. Has that been a smooth transition from the former government? Have you been, I guess, given the keys to your ministry, as they say? Has it gone smoothly?
It's early days. I've only been here. This is my fourth day in the office. As you can understand, it was over the holiday period, so we had some staff missing from the office. But otherwise, all in all, it has been smooth so far. I think this coming weeks, we're yet to see, you know, get into the nitty gritty of, you know, for what is in the ministry. I do look forward to it and to working with the staff that are here. Apart from a few pending issues, I know so far it's so good.
Okay, well, that's good news. Now, Minister Tambuya, let's go into, I guess, the contents of what you might be doing while in office. Now, I understand, according to the 2019-2020 household survey, 3 out of every 10 Fijians live in poverty, and that could likely be worse now because of the pandemic. What do you hope to do to address this?
Thank you. As we see our budget for our ministry, the largest portion of our budget is allocated to poverty alleviation. So our social welfare programs form the largest portion of our budget for the ministry. So we are reviewing that because at the moment they are being paid up to $100 a month, which we see is clearly not enough to at least to meet the cost of living, which is why one of our urgent commitments in the first 100 days is to review this social welfare allowance that we give to our elderly as well as our people living with disabilities and our children at risk.
And how will you go about reviewing this welfare allowance?
Well, we are currently, you know, as we sit as cabinet, we've had invitation from the Ministry of Finance to make a submission. Now, we are, you know, clearly the cost of living where it's at and comparing it to what our people are receiving in the social welfare allowances, we feel is not enough. And so with that dollar figure of $100 a month, we will look at increasing it. That's certainly part of our review. We hope to, you know, find that money. We feel that there has been a lot of government wastage by the previous government. You know, that funding, reducing government wastage in our ministry and allocating it to our social programs, we are committed to doing that.
Now, Minister Tambuya, when we talk about inequalities and indeed poverty, economists say we can't ignore the inequalities between ethnicities in Fiji. They say data, and in fact there is data, that shows that indigenous Itoke Fijians are much more likely to live under the poverty line than any other ethnic group in Fiji. Now, Minister, is that something that your government will also look into and consider?
Yes, in the previous government, we had been requesting for years to have access to the ethnic data. And this had been, avoided by the previous government for many years, until last year, when the report on the household and income and expenditure survey was published by the then CEO of the Bureau of Statistics, who then was terminated from his job for doing so. Again, the previous government not following due process, and so them picking on us now, not doing the same, you know, is something they need to reflect on. But it has been the hallmark of the previous government to hire and fire at will. So this was a clear case of what happened to the former CEO for releasing the ethnic data, which then revealed the, you know, the 75% of Itaoke or indigenous Fijians under the poverty line. This is certainly something we do need to consider. We do need to look at, you know, not just equality of our programs, but also equity. And that is, you know, access to resources, and certainly, you know, poverty alleviation is no exception.
Mm. Now, you are also the Minister of Women, Minister Tambuya, and I understand you are the only woman in cabinet as well. Is that a bit of a disappointing outcome from this election?
It is a disappointing outcome. I wish that we had had more women that was with me in cabinet. We've got three assistant ministers who are women, myself being the only woman in cabinet. It is of great concern, and I will continue to, you know, try to find young women leaders or women leaders that will come into politics and engage for 2026. I believe it's been the very nature of the election environment in Fiji that has deterred many women from participating in elections. The culture of fear, and bullying and intimidation, you know, women are, and of course the levels of poverty, women are certainly busy engaged in, you know, trying to sustain their families and, you know, trying to meet the daily needs of their families. And we've got to commend that. They are women leaders in their own families and in their own communities. But when it comes to politics, it's been a costly exercise for a woman candidate. It's also something that in the culture of fear and intimidation is something that women don't usually sign up for. But, you know, I encourage all women in the next elections that they will come forward. But, you know, that doesn't deter me as the only woman cabinet member to really try to push for the increased visibility of women in leadership positions, not just in the government, but also in boards and any commissions. So I'm pushing for that. But more importantly, for our work here at the ministry, is the need to increase women in the areas of economic empowerment. You know, if we're looking at the current drain of our brain, so to speak, we've got quite a lot of tradespeople and the like that are leaving on our, you know,
coming to Australia, in fact, coming to Australia.
Minister. Yes, it is a huge concern for us. You know, we've got it's almost 12,000 now, I believe, that have come over. And we are not just we are losing a lot of our tradespeople and professionals in that regard. So I would like to see an increased participation of women to be trained here in the trade space. I We'll be appealing to the Australia Pacific Training Coalition, the APTC, because they do offer courses on built environment, which is carpentry and plumbing and tiling, as well as engineering. I'd like to see more women to be, you know, participate in that and to be trained so that they can replace the brain drain that we've suffered. I feel that, you know, women will have more commitment to stay in the country
and to give
back here because they're looking after their families and they're committed and have more roots here.
Do you think, Minister Tambuya, sorry to interrupt you, do you think there should be a review of Australia's labour scheme? I mean, we've heard that nurses from Fiji, predominantly women who earn those jobs, are leaving their jobs to come to Australia. Do you think that scheme should be under review?
I believe in the scheme. I think we should be able to give our people the opportunity. However, we as a country do need to see how we can replace and like we can fill that void. We do have an imbalance generally of having a lot of expatriates that are taking up the jobs in Fiji, and we are losing our people to, you know, to overseas. So we need to address that imbalance. You know, if we are able to fill the positions here of by our own people, and if people are leaving to go on that scheme, then we as a country need to, and as a government need to see to fill those positions, to train our people and incent them to stay.
Well, you've got a lot of work ahead of you, Minister Tambuya, but thank you so much for your time this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you. Vinakavakalevu.
That was Minister Tambuya, the new Minister of Women, Children and Poverty Alleviation, speaking to us there. And you're tuned in to Pacific Beat here on Radio Australia. My name is Priyanka Srinivasan. It's been almost a year since a devastating tsunami struck Tonga, destroying homes, businesses and farms. For those in the worst affected islands, Atata, the last 12 months have been spent living with family or in crisis accommodation on the mainland. But for some, including Atata resident Ilseva Tuivai, a new chapter began on Christmas Day when she moved into a new home on the mainland built by the government. Remembering the day when the tsunami hit, she told the ABC's Marion Farr that she left her daughter and mother at home and went to work in the garden.
And when I get to the plantation, I hear a pom or something like that. And I start to cry. I know that something happened. And I ran back from the plantation to the village to see my mom. And when I get to the village, the seawater is covered over the island. And all the house and the things gone.
And was your house destroyed?
I saw my house still stand. And when I come to get my mom, my house is, the window and everything broken. And my mom's still in the house with my daughter. And my daughter just carried my mom up to breathe because my house is all over the water. When my daughter ran to get to the highland, sea water just take my daughter to the sea and I don't know where my daughter is. And when I get to the highland with my mom, and I'll come back to see my daughter, where my daughter. And when I come in south in the beach, I can't find her.
My goodness, that must have been terrifying. Did you manage to find your daughter?
My brother come again and see where my daughter. And he know my daughter was on the beach. And my brother carried my daughter to the highland.
That's a relief that your daughter was safe. But what about your house? Did it survive?
My house gone. Everything gone. We can't find anything. We just come to the mainland with the boat.
Now, everyone from Atata was relocated to the mainland, Tonga Tapu, after the tsunami. Many people have been living with families or in crisis accommodation since then. What has that been like for you?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for me because when we live in Atata, that's very good thing. But when we come to Tonga, is very, very different. It's hard for me because we have to spend money for the power and spend money for the water and the food and everything like that. But when we in Atata, everything free, yeah, it's very different.
Now, you and a number of families from Atata have just recently been relocated into new homes built by the Tongan government. Now, these homes are on the Tongan mainland in a new village called Atata. How did it feel to move into your new home?
Yes, today I'm staying in my new home. We feel free to come to our new home, but we're not the same with Atata. We come here, we have to spend money for the power.
So why did you have to relocate permanently to the mainland? Couldn't you go back to Atata Island?
It's very hard to go back to Atata because it's easy for the hurricane and the tsunami to come because it's very low now. Yeah, that's why we never go back home to Atata.
And what's your new home in the mainland like? Have you settled in?
That's good. Our new home, that's very nice. Our new home, but we have to grow our own food and something like that. I just grow a little food in my home, beside my home. I just grow some taro and breadfruit tree, banana and something like that. So we start to grow something for my family. I try to find my job, but it's very hard because we living from far away from town and we have to go by our own car or something like that, or we have to go by bus or something like that. We can have money to spend for the fees. It's very hard because when I am staying in Atata, I'm working on the little resort there. So I have to walk morning and afternoon to work. But in here, we have to go by bus or by car or something like that. It's very different.
Mm. Are you happy with what the government has provided?
Yeah, I'm happy because they give us our land and the house. I'm happy for that.
That was a Tongan mother, Elsiva Tuivai, speaking there with reporter Marion Farr. And another one of those islands that was affected by the tsunami was Mungo Island, where every single house there was wiped out. The people of Mungo Island have been living in a hall in capital Nuku'alofa since January 15 last year when that tsunami hit. But now they've also been recently resettled elsewhere in Tonga. Musese Vakaisiola has been managing the Mungo Island resettlement project and joins us now on the line. Good morning to you, Musese.
Good morning.
Now, we were just hearing, I don't know if you were tuning in there, but we heard from one woman. She was sharing her thanks and her happiness for being relocated. She was from Atata, relocated to a new place. She's also shared some reservations about leaving her homeland, leaving her life, leaving her livelihood. You're helping with some of these other resettlement projects. Are you hearing similar stories?
Yes, that's correct. Emotion is the same with those people, Mango and Atata. They've lost their identity, basically. So now we are trying to create a new environment for them.
I mean, that must be difficult. How is your project going about to do that?
My project is looking to provide the housing to start with. Along the line will come their livelihood. We will help them with farming, starting fresh up in Ewa and help them with the to develop their community.
So quite a long process, I guess, that you have ahead of you, Musase. How did you get involved with this particular resettlement project for the people of Mungo Island?
Where should I start? I work for the palace office in Nukualofa, retired as a colonel from His Majesty Armed Forces, and I picked up this job. The office belongs to His Majesty King Tupou the Sixth and the Queen Nandasipau. And the people of Mango is one of his royal estate. There's another village, it's going to be relocated as well, Kandokupolu. Mm-hmm. That's the second estate. So Mango, it's different. We're moving Mango from the island to another island, meaning it's going to be changing the lifestyle. And I was assigned to manage these two projects.
Okay. And how have people responded to having to, I guess, leave an island that I imagine they've spent generations in on Mango to leave somewhere new? Why was that decision made?
Based on scientific reports that the island is not fit for settlement. And the people feel they've lost their homes. I've been trying since day one to get an answer why people are going back in previous relocation here in Tonga. 1946, the people from the UFO, the furthest island to the north, there was a eruption. They were relocated here to Nukualofa, and then from Nukualofa to Ewa. Same island that the Mango people are going to.
Oh, really?
12 years, yes. 12 years after they went back.
Oh, so the original people from 1946 have gone back to their home island?
Yes, some, yes.
Okay.
So some has gone back.
So could it be a similar case for the people of Mango Island? Is there still a bit of hope that they may in a few decades return home to their home island?
Home island, yes. But our job, our project team job, is to avoid this from happening. And that's why we're crafting this project to not only build them temporary or permanent housing, but always create an environment that they could want to stay. Mango people are very fishing-oriented people. Mm-hmm. Now we're moving them to Ewa. Ewa is a agricultural-oriented community. So I have to work around something to cater for that.
Mm. Yes, yes. It sounds like you've got, like I said earlier, a lot of work ahead of you in this resettlement, Musese, there in Tonga. And part of this, I guess, is also addressing the trauma of these people who've lived through something quite catastrophic, this devastating tsunami and eruption from last year. We were hearing earlier from one person who went through that and had to be evacuated. Is that part of what you're looking at when you're resettling these people as well, addressing some of their mental health concerns?
Yes, we will work on that in the later in the stage. From my experience, about a month ago, there was a tsunami warning. Mm. We have the tsunami alert system up and running. Just opened about mid last year. And the first one went off like November. The first thing came to my mind, how are these people? I called them later at night, that night, and they were frustrated. Well, frustrated, but they still had the sense from the eruption, and they were pretty scared that night. In the future, I think it's going to go along for a long time before people like get used to it.
Yes, I mean, it sounds like, I guess, trauma, a traumatic response to something quite triggering for them, that tsunami bell or alert.
Yep, yes.
A difficult thing to overcome. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see in this resettlement project?
Mentally, getting people to accept that they have to move from those islands to higher ground.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I mean, I guess they've been living, as we've been saying, for generations on Mango Island. Now having to relocate must be difficult. I wanted to ask you, Mosese, I guess there has been some good news that they are finally out of temporary accommodation. How has it been for you to be part of this resettlement project? How do you feel about it?
I'm very fortunate to take this role of managing this resettlement project. I feel that this is another chapter, not only the people, the country, and personally myself. I've just learned a few interesting part of my history when I did this, started the resettlement project. And I'm pretty happy with the progress. Pretty happy with what I'm doing right now.
Oh, well, that's very good to hear. I know there's a lot of work ahead for you there, but all the best. And thank you so much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat.
Yep. Thank you very much.
And that was Mosese Vakasiola, who's managing one of the resettlement projects for people who were displaced by the tsunami there last year in January. He's helping to resettle those from Mango Island to a new place in Ewa. And we've still got more stories for you here on Pacific Beat coming up this Tuesday morning. Don't go anywhere. We'll be hearing about this new informal market opening up between Solomon Islands and Australia for something called betel nut. You might know it if you do live in the Pacific, or if you're like me, have family in India. It's also very big in India. Betel nut is hard to come by in Australia, though, which is why some people are trying to, in some ways, smuggle it into the country and sell it to the thousands of people from Solomon Islands here in Australia. We'll hear about that shortly. And we'll also hear about how to protect your mental health. We just heard about some of the mental health difficulties, the impacts from people in Tonga recovering from the tsunami there. But there are so many things, little things from daily stresses to big things like COVID-19 and the impact of that pandemic on our mental health. We'll be hearing soon after this break about what we can do to protect our mental health.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Women have their specific needs. If a woman is menstruating and she's out in the farm, there should be sanitary pads or sanitary dignity packs, we call it, that should be made available in the farms.
So join me for Sisters Let's Talk, Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Hope you're having a lovely Tuesday morning. A new market has emerged supplying thousands of Solomon Islands seasonal workers in Australia with a taste of home. Betel nut may be an acquired taste, but demand is rising and it's seeing suppliers freeze, pack and send the fruits to buyers overseas. Chris and Rita Amano Leong in Honiara with this report.
Honiara's western end is a trading hub of small roadside stalls, with more than 50 betel nut sellers impatiently waiting for the daily supply of betel nut to arrive. Regina Guaina is out here most mornings, heat, rain or cold, in search of her supply of fruits to sell locally and overseas. She's been supplying betel nut to Australia for more than a year.
Getting the right kind of betel nut is difficult work. We have to wait at the wharves, the coastlines, or at the betel nut markets. When we buy the betel nuts, we remove the skin and we wrap it in a plastic wrap before putting it in the aluminium foil and into the freezer.
Ms. Guina says frozen fruits can be stored up to a month, but the mustard leaf is hand-picked on flight day. Australia's biosecurity law allows any passenger to carry 2 kilograms of mustard leaf and 10 kilograms of betel nut. Solomon Islander James Meyokolengi travels to Australia frequently, but he still feels uneasy carrying betel nuts after a terrifying experience nearly ended with a huge fine.
Before we collected all the luggage and everything, the security came through and like just lined us up. It's like, all right, we're going to do a sniffer dog, going to check everyone here. And then, yeah, the dog just came through, sniffed the bags, walk around everyone. And then when the dog came up to me, the dog just sniffed my pocket and then sit down straight. And everyone's like looking at me. I was like, oh, no, something. But I have no idea what's in my pocket.
Lengi left Honiara Airport chewing his betel nut, but forgot the skin in his pocket until a biosecurity officer removed it.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, you know you're not allowed to bring this. I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. I know you're not allowed to, but I didn't mean to bring it. I was planning to clean my teeth with the betel nut skin.
He was later issued a warning letter, but now travels freely with his supply of betel nuts. A Solomon Islands biosecurity officer says they are seeing an increase in the amount of betel nut taken from Honiara to Australia. All of it happening at an informal level. Emily De La Verata is a seasonal worker and spends up to $200 a week on betel nut. She insists it's a better option than fast food.
No, I would rather spend $50 for betel nut than KFC. I will do it, yes. It's like a pack and there's like 3 betel nuts, 3 fruits, I mean betel nuts inside and 2 leaves. So it's $10 for a betel nut, $10 Australian. You compare that back home, maybe what, almost $60, Solomon? It's expensive, but we can't say it. When there's betel nut, we don't even think about the price.
Betel nut is popular among his Solomon colleagues who have found themselves forking out extra money for postal fees.
And there's heaps of suppliers, but it depends on which kind of place you go work to and where you live. Like if the supply is closer, then you'd get betel nuts. Sometimes we live far away, people post it over to us or my friends, and then we have to pay the betel nut and the posting as well.
Betel nut suppliers in Honiara might be meeting the demand in Australia. But James Meyokolengi says there is a more convenient solution for those in Australia.
I live in Darwin more than 10 years now. In Darwin, there's betel nut trees everywhere. So I usually buy betel nuts from a lady from PNG and the husband, and also there's an old couple from East Timor.
And that was James Meyokolengi speaking there to reporter Kristen Rita Amanu Leong from Honiara. You're listening to Pacific Beat, and it's our second episode for 2023. The end of one year and the start of another is often a time for reflection, rest, and then goal setting. As we start 2023, what plans do you have to address your mental health? In Vanuatu, Dr. Jimmy Obed, the country's only psychiatrist, is working hard to make sure mental health was front and center of people's minds in 2022, and I'm sure in 2023 as well. He joins us now. Good morning to you, Dr. Obed.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Monica.
Yes, thank you for being here. It's such an important issue, mental health. What do you do yourself, Dr. Obed, perhaps at the start of every year, to prioritize your own mental health?
Every beginning of the year, everyone has a New Year's resolution. And I think for me, the year 2022 was a huge year with the community outbreak.
Well, we might have just lost Dr. Obed. Unfortunately, it's the case sometimes with calling into the Pacific, we can have dropped connections. But we are speaking to Dr. Obed. He is the only psychiatrist there in Vanuatu. We want to ask him about mental health, particularly after the difficult few years. I mean, 2022, we think the pandemic is behind us, but 2022 has seen stresses like still closed borders, community transmission in some countries. Dr. Obed, I think, was just beginning to say that Vanuatu only just started seeing quite heavy rates of community transmission this year of COVID-19. That does have an impact on people's mental health. Dr. Obed, I believe you're back on the line. Is that what you were saying, the impact of COVID-19 and community transmission in Vanuatu?
Yes. So, yeah, it's important for us to have, we look at the importance of our mental health and, nourishing our bodies, learning to take care of ourselves. I think those are some things that, we really have to take to the forefront of our everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, some good resolutions there. For many of us, though, the past 2 years have just been incredibly stressful. We've had the COVID-19 pandemic. Some people have lost loved ones, particularly those maybe who are listening in Fiji. There's been, I think, worldwide just the isolation, fear around the virus, sometimes fear around vaccines. The pandemic might be over, but is the stress still present with us?
Yes, I think the stress is still there. I mean, we're beginning to get back on our feet and try to get things back to normal. But then what even is normal now for us? So I think the stress of just that and having to go back into the routine of life, not knowing what is ahead of us, not knowing if the pandemic is even over, those kind of stuff, I think, poses stress. Yet to a lot of us in our communities.
Yes. How can that stress manifest? Can we see it? How do we see it? How can we identify it?
I think for us here in my observation here in Vanuatu, I think there's a lot of substance use. People going to alcohol, even increase the number of kava intake, just to try and relax people. There's a lot of relationship issues, and I think those are the signs that our community is being distressed or stressed out. Things like suicide as well is something that we don't often talk about that much. I think here in Vanuatu, we tend to see a lot of suicide, mostly in the islands as well. People attempting to commit suicide, especially young people, just because of the stress on top of the everyday difficulties living in everyday life.
And speaking of that stress and some of the more severe cases, we heard earlier from some people in Tonga and about some of the post-traumatic stress disorder that they might have experienced from seeing a great natural disaster like the tsunami that they had. Is that something that's also common that you see around in the islands as well, Dr. Obed? How can we identify and treat that?
Yeah, I think just the fact that, like, for Vanuatu now that we have opened borders and we're into our cyclone season, so there's anxiety as well of, what is out there for us in terms of natural disaster. But I think a lot of people are becoming aware of the anxious behavior that they have. The subtle signs that their bodies are telling them, they have this chest pains and shortness of breath and just being hypervigilant, signs of post-traumatic stress, being easily irritated, withdrawal from the normal activities and things like that. I think those are subtle signs that people are being traumatized by COVID itself, by natural disasters. And I think a lot more people I'm beginning to observe are becoming aware of the subtle signs of mental health issues surrounding them. So I think a lot more people are becoming more welcoming and beginning to have those conversations around, oh, there's something not right about how I feel, how I think, my emotions, and beginning to look for places where they can get help.
Yes, because Dr. Obed, I know you've been over the last year trying to raise awareness around mental health in Vanuatu. I mean, is that one of the the challenges, that it is so subtle? Opposed to like a broken leg or a cut that you have, it can be hard to actually identify that you have a problem that you need treated, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And with a lot of awareness, people are becoming more aware of it now. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for us here in the Pacific, when something doesn't feel right, we run to traditional healers, we run to our churches and try and seek support and help. But just the fact that people are becoming aware of it even more during the pandemic and into this, you know, this year, just those subtle signs, people are becoming more aware and discussing it and sharing information. And, you know, on Facebook, we have here Facebook pages of information where the community can access and see and put a finger onto, oh, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I should do, this is how I should take care of myself, and this is where I should go to get help. And so we're beginning to see a lot of that. And I think COVID and our community outbreak brought that out because there was a lot of information put out on social media. People were at home. The only place they could get information was either the radio or on Facebook. So a lot of that information brought, you know, a lot of clarity for people to understand that this is something that is important and we need to discuss and we need to find help.
Yes.
If we need, yes.
Yes, that is, I guess, one silver lining from COVID-19. I mean, if there is this awareness, maybe people are listening and think, okay, I've got these heart palpitations, I've got starting to get irritated, I'm perhaps abusing substances. What can they do?
That is the challenge, I guess. I mean, services, and I know in the Pacific there's very limited number of services that are available, but also, in our communities, we, and in here in Vanuatu, the experience is we try and inform and resource communities because of our culture. People are very communal, and I think they get a lot of support from the groups and the activities within communities, church groups and, you know, leaders in the community. So we've tried to go and give skills, basic skills of psychological first aid, for example, here in Vanuatu to church leaders where they can provide some basic support to people. And I think it's one thing to be aware and understand that this is something wrong. And there's another thing for what do I do about it? Where can I go to get help if I need it? So we're trying to go into tapping into those areas and networks and communities to let communities take ownership of this and say, this is important. We can do something about it. And, you know, PFA, psychological first aid, is something that anybody can do. You don't need a specialist to. So we're just trying to strengthen these systems already existing within our communities to provide that support to people who need it.
Yes, I guess awareness is the key, and then going to the right people is the next step. In severe cases, is there sometimes a need for medication to treat people's mental health? And is that medication even available in the Pacific?
Yes, I think in terms of medication, I think a lot of our Pacific countries have mental health clinics. And if you're lucky, you have two or more psychiatrists or mental health specialists in your country to provide you with that service as well. And even with medication, I understand there's a lot of challenges with access to medication and access to current medication. Like here in Vanuatu, we have medication to treat, but we only have a limited stock, and they're the older generation of medication.
Mm.
And we're trying to find ways, and we're tapping into resources and our networks from Australia, New Zealand to support us with treatment medication-wise. So there is medication if you become very severely unwell for treatment, but it can be very limited in some countries as well.
Well, as we've been talking about, there are things that we can do to take our mental health into our own hands. Looking into the new year, Dr. Obed, do you have a couple of tips that you can share with listeners about how to take care of their mental health?
Sure. I think one of the important things, I think, for us, especially Pacific Islanders, is to know our limits and to know when to say no. Sometimes we're living in a very communal society. When we say self-care, it's almost something like, oh, I can't do that. It's not a Pacific way. I have to think of my family. I have to think of this person. I have to think of my responsibilities. But just knowing your limit is a good start to say no to things and to take care of yourself, make time for yourself. Also, like, you know, listen to your body. Your body will tell you that, you know, you're going through a lot of stress. You need to take a break. So your body will tell you that, whether it be through fatigue, problems, sleep problems, aches and pains. So you need to take note of that and listen to your body and know when to stop and breathe. Nourish your body, your mind, your soul, your spirit, and that you know, everything that's about you. Mm. Our culture is very, you know, you have Christianity, lean on to some spiritual, you know, nourish your spirit as well as your mind, your body, and your soul. Make time to do things that, you know, contribute to positive mental health. And I think lastly is just to stay connected and, you know, invest in meaningful relationships, whether it be to your relatives, your good friend, whether it be to nature, to your, you know, custom and tradition and things like that, to nourish us. Because those things are our pillars in the Pacific. So that's some Pacific ways to take care of yourself.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Obed. They are very useful tips as we go into 2023. That was Dr. Jimmy Obed, Vanuatu's only psychiatrist. And if you if this story brought up any issues, you have the Mind Care Clinic in Vanuatu. That's on 678-22512. That can help. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Thank you for your company today on Pacific Beat, and hope you have a lovely and mentally healthful good day.